Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, we've got updates as retailers begin to open throughout the country with various restrictions. We'll kind of cover the retailers announcing they were going to reopen stores and the provisions they'll be taking this coming week or this coming month. We're also going to talk about eBay as they released earnings this week. One of the retailers or retail marketplaces that could be reasonably expected to perhaps benefit from all the stay-at-home orders. We've also got an interview with Paul Cohen. He's the Crexie National Sales Director. He's going to talk a little bit about the Crexie platform, but also what he's seeing as far as retail real estate surrounding COVID-19 and some of the trends there, at least the trends that he can possibly foresee given his experience in the industry. A reminder, you can like us and rate us however you access us, whether that be on Stitcher or Podcast Addict or Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and so forth. You can also reach out to us on social media at Retail Podcast on both Instagram and Twitter. So we begin with the reopening. You know, that Leighton, we've talked about it before the podcast. Negative news travels faster than positive news, certainly. And we've seen our share of negative news over the past couple of weeks. Negative news generates clicks. It's why on the local news, they say if it bleeds, it leads. But we're going to take a different approach here. We're finally going to look at some of the positives as far as retailers reopening. And you can make the argument potentially, well, that might not be a positive because they're putting people at risk. But ultimately, a lot of retailers, a lot of retail employees excited to get to reopen. And some states, as we mentioned in our Looking Ahead segment last week, are allowing retailers that are non-essential to reopen while other states are continuing restrictions.
And this actually goes for the restaurant industry as well, where some restaurants are being allowed to open with restrictions on the number of people inside. Part of the movement we are seeing is due to the calendar switching over to May 1st, as the number of stay-at-home orders were actually scheduled to end around this time. In different states, a lot had pegged May 1st as a time to reopen for certain retailers. We'll go through a retailer-by-retailer update based on the information we have as of this last weekend. So first, we have Macy's. The embattled department store retailer is set to open around 68 stores on Monday, May 4th. The 68 stores are the trial balloon of sorts, with 50 more scheduled to reopen on May 11th, according to the CEO, Jeff Gennette. This is part of a plan to reopen a majority of their 775 stores in around 8 weeks' time. Some media outlets stated that Macy's would reopen all stores within 6 weeks, quoting a Macy's spokeswoman. However, there were multiple caveats given by the spokeswoman, including easing of local restrictions. It seems as though Jeanette's forecast is probably closer to reality, however. This information comes from a call Jeanette had this past week with Gordon Haskett Research Advisors. Macy's expects traffic to be limited at first, of course, given numbers seen in Asia and Europe from reopening retailers there. Jeanette specifically mentioned initial sales volume around 20% of the usual. So we're talking about 1/5 of normal customer traffic levels that is expected within their stores. They are hoping to boost online fulfillment, though, in brick and mortar locations as stores open. While this is already kind of a part of their long-term plan, Trent, the build-out has been accelerated. For example, as of this week, only 466 stores had the capacity to assist with online fulfillment, and they're looking to expand that quite rapidly. CFO Paula Price noted on the call that currently Macy's is only burning through around $40 million a week, down from earlier expectations with the company. And this has a lot to do with what we've seen on all of those, of course, negative media headlines, Trent, with furloughs and layoffs. But this is in part due to online sales really helping revenue streams for Macy's, but also due to those aggressive furloughs and cost-cutting measures that they've announced over the last month or so. Price also revealed their potential approach to inventory originally ticketed for sales over the past 8 weeks. It will vary based on the vendor. They anticipate pack and hold for some and markdowns for others, with extended terms with vendors in certain circumstances. Also, we would anticipate some product flowing through to off-price stores, who we mentioned in March as a potential winner once they reopen, in part because of the potential deals from vendors and other struggling retailers. We're particularly interested to see which retailers implement pack and hold as a mechanism, especially those running low on space with which to do so. Macy's, of course, no shortage of space in any of their locations or distribution centers for that matter. Let's take a moment now to discuss exactly why Macy's would be motivated to open while drawing only 20% of their usual sales volume. And I say 20% of the usual sales volume because that's the amount of traffic they anticipate coming into those newly opened stores. And so much of it has to do with the idea held by many retail experts out there that we won't really see or know if there's a recovery until the recovery has actually already happened. In our discussions outside of the podcast with some major figures in the retail real estate space, it is believed that things will gradually ramp up again for most retailers. Therefore, Macy's may take a loss in the short term by reopening with revenues only 20% of usual. They may be really seeking to position themselves prematurely in a more favorable position against retailers who are waiting to open, perhaps gaining market share in the short term and in this process of opening before others. It is a consensus opinion, at least from the experts we've talked to, that the retailers who wait the longest may be in the roughest shape. So in theory, opening with a lower sales volume and gradually ramping up to allow store employees to assist in any necessary maintenance and merchandise turnover necessary from the earlier closures may really assist Macy's going forward, especially for clothing retailers overall. They may need to really have a complete reset of product. For Macy's in particular, they were focused on quicker turns. As such, they'll have a lot to do before the stores reopen. And even once they are open, there's a lot of work to be done, Trent.
Yeah, you mentioned Macy's on the quicker turns. There were interviews that we had in the earlier part of the year that suggested a lot of fashion retailers were even switching to weekly turns rather than monthly or seasonal turns. So for those retailers, obviously merchandise turnover is going to be a big issue, but there's a lot that's going to need to be done when they do open up the stores. Now, Jeanette did mention that they remain committed to closing 125 stores over the next 3 years, as was their earlier plan, but that there is a potential that they will revisit their closing plans, because overall, it's a given that closing more stores might be a necessity for them. Now, I'm not saying that they were on terrible financial footing to begin with, because they were sometimes profitable. There was a dividend coming out on their stock, but overall, you look at the financial hit that they've taken, and yeah, $40 million a week isn't that much in terms of a lawsuit. Wayfair loses more in a week if you look at some of their quarterly earnings calls. But Jeanette did say, and I quote this, "We're going to emerge out of this a smaller company." Now, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, kind of up to the eye of the beholder, because some analysts saying that Macy's was overextended and should unlock value in their real estate, while others are saying that, hey, they need to retain that economy of scale to be a factor here in terms of price and competing on price where necessary. Now, they did send out a presentation provided to employees. And when looking at this presentation, it appears that Macy's is targeting around 550 of their stores to be open around mid-June. And going back, Leighton mentioned at the beginning that the spokeswoman said to CNBC that, hey, we're looking to open all of our stores up in the next 6 weeks. I think that's a little optimistic. And Macy's internally, at least, we can see from this presentation, certainly not planning to reopen all of their stores by mid-June. I do think you're looking more realistically at a majority of stores open within 8 weeks prospect, especially with some areas, including New York, of course, maybe needing to stay quarantined or stay at home for a longer period of time than others. I mentioned this to someone this last week, but conditions in New York should not determine what a retailer does in, say, rural Montana, if you're looking at maybe the policies held between the two of them. And that's something that's kind of a consistent theme that we're seeing, is a lot of retailers are just waiting on local governments and putting it on the local government's shoulders as far as when they're reopening. But back to this Macy's presentation. In the same presentation, they noted, of course, various procedures would be implemented for the safety of employees, including sneeze guards, sanitation supplies, standard stuff, staff training as well, with the purpose of enforcing social distancing and limiting contact across all parties. But if you've ever been to a Macy's, you know that there are higher contact and higher interaction areas. You look at jewelry, you look at beauty. To this end, they're actually going to implement measures where associates are not to touch customers in either jewelry or beauty. They're going to force customers to sanitize before trying on jewelry. Testers will be using single-use disposable applicators when necessary for things like lotions, for things like perfumes. Also, any spa-type services that the stores have, any piercing services that the stores have, will be suspended at least temporarily. Also, alterations are being suspended at least temporarily, trying to keep staff and employees from measuring people that come in and their customers that come in. Dress shirts and other clothing will be also unavailable for in-store try-on. So really, not only trying to minimize the contact that customers have with employees and vice versa, also trying to minimize the direct impact and the direct touch that customers have with the clothing and the other merchandise that's there. They also mentioned that for a Macy's store to reopen, it must be financially attractive to do so. And again, direct quote, financially attractive. And they must have minimum viable staffing for reopening. Basically, enough people must be willing to work for that store to reopen. I want you to remember that financially attractive part, because it comes into play with other retailers actually saying that that might not be a factor for them, that they're simply just waiting on local mechanisms. Now let's talk about Five Below, because we mentioned we're going to talk about several different retailers as they look to reopen. Five Below operates in a much different segment than Macy's, but the story for Five Below is similar to their legacy retailer counterpart. They've already begun reopening stores this past week. 17 total were opened during the week of April 20th. Over 100 opened this past week. So we're looking at around 120 stores reopened in 8 total states. So their schedule has them in front of Macy's by a little bit, desiring what they say are the majority of their stores to open by early June. So we're looking at maybe 2 to 4 weeks ahead of Macy's for Five Below. Now, for reference, I mentioned 120 stores reopened in 8 total states. They currently have over 900 locations across 36 states. So there is a longer way to go with Five Below. Now, they announced along with opening plans that the year would probably see 60 to 80 fewer openings than originally expected as a result of COVID-19. Coming into this year, this fiscal year at least, they had ticketed about 180 stores to be opened additionally. So that would push them over 1,000 on the store count mark. They say now that number probably going to be around 100 to 120. They also announced the pushing back of the opening of a Midwest distribution center until 2022. Now, Leighton, Five Below is a pretty interesting case here, because they had as good a case as any retailer to stay open. And although the majority of what they sell could be deemed non-essential, they do have a decent amount of food and some HBA items as well.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. They'd actually have a better case than some of the retailers who stayed open over the past month and a half, in fact. But because they don't really have the marketplace position that maybe some of the other dollar store retailers have, most notably as neighborhood variety stores, it did make sense to close the stores from a financial perspective as well, if you're the management there at Five Below. Let's keep in mind who their customers are too. Tweens and teens, by and large. Most parents aren't exactly letting their kids go out and shop right now during this pandemic. But if you look, also the shopping centers most Five Belows take up in are deserted, as other retailers like Off-Pricers have been closing during this time. A lot of Five Belows are also close to Bed Bath & Beyond stores, who, of course, are closed as well. Also Kohl's. All of the larger neighborhood shopping centers that Five Below is really looking to occupy, a lot of those really truly are deserted right now. Overall, the rapid reopening targeted by Five Below might be welcome news for their employees, the vast majority of which who have been furloughed since March 31st. These employees had their healthcare benefits run out by the end of April, so you know that many employees are really chomping at the bit to get back into the store and start working again. And there are likely some who are hesitant, if you're an employee, to jump back in, given some of the current conditions and some of the municipalities, of course. But even still, there will be enough employees willing to work that we don't really foresee this being an issue for most of their store locations that are going to reopen. Employees returning to work, by the way, will be forced to wear face coverings as a safety measure. CEO Joel Anderson said in the release, "Our stores are set for summer," although it was not exactly clear how the company would deal with the potential stale spring seasonal merchandise that they had brought into their stores that probably didn't sell through a whole lot over the past 2 months. Unlike fashion retailers, Five Below sales do not hinge as heavily on seasonal sales, but it is a decently sized part of their overall revenue and has been one of their stronger categories, as we report on their quarterly earnings calls, along with their Create and Candy in their Now world. And I say Create and Candy, they have different sections. Their different worlds are their product groups. So instead of maybe those conventional groups we talk about with other more conventional retailers, they like to have a different spin on their different sectors. But during their latest earnings call, they did mention Packaway as a potential strategy for seasonal merchandise, given their recently increased distribution center capacity, which would be of assistance in times like these. They did mention, in general terms, canceling orders and delaying receipts to manage inventory levels, but this was a bit vague as far as the level of insight into their strategy here. It may be a difficult position for them on the inventory front overall, as inventory on a per store basis was already up 11% year over year as of their latest quarter. We move on from Five Below to Dillard's. Dillard's obviously is still a very large presence in the department store space. Credit goes to Dillard's here, as well as they were very transparent about their store opening plans this week. Ultimately, there was little surprise here, with most Dillard's stores being in geographical areas that are pushing to reopen their economies as of late. Dillard's is based in Arkansas, who has been particularly headstrong about reopening much of retail. Their plan, Dillard's plan here, is to reopen 55 select locations beginning on May 5th. The states include Arkansas, Colorado, Georgia, Mississippi, Missouri, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, and, of course, Utah. And Trent, just real quick before I move on, I did note when I was in Arkansas recently and in Tennessee, they were one of the only department stores, and this was 4 weeks ago, so this wasn't super recently. They were one of the only department stores, one of the only stores in a lot of those older conventional malls that remained open. So while the malls were either closed or thinking about closing, Dillard's did not care. They were operating as usual, but they were taking proper safety precautions. They were abiding by a 6-foot rule for social distancing, and their employees, most of which were wearing face masks. But credit to Dillard's, who's been very transparent this whole time, to kind of go back to what I said at the beginning of this story. But the 55 locations here is reflective of nearly 20% of their overall store footprint, which sits around 280 stores if you do the math. In total, they have, for reference, 257 full-line stores and 28 clearance centers. So they said basically they will open stores as soon as possible, essentially indicating that they are not weighing the variables like financial stability of each individual location or the staffing like Macy's is currently looking at.
So let's finish up here by giving a quick brief rundown of other retailers reopening. At Home said this week that approximately half of their stores would open by May 1st. So Friday, May 1st, that's already passed. They are limiting the number of customers in the stores at any given time. But again, the stores that they were able to open kind of hinging on local government regulations. Now, Ulta, which is often a co-tenant with Five Below, we talked about earlier, they began curbside pickup at around 350 of their stores this past week. However, full reopening of the stores still very much in question. The company saying that their speed as far as reopening, that's going to vary largely on region. Now, Retail Dive noted that in early April, Ulta cut back on plans to open 75 new stores this year as a result of COVID-19 impacts. And we should mention that a retailer like Ulta, you see a lot of areas in the store where there is a high concentration of interaction directly between employees and consumers, a lot of sampling, a lot of trying things out. So obviously that's going to complicate things for Ulta, who has, again, just been killing it the last few years, but they are one of the retailers that might have a tougher time reopening simply because of some of these restrictions. And then alongside the aforementioned Dillard's, another Southern clothing staple in Belk is also looking towards reopenings this weekend as we record the podcast. Now, hours for them are going to be significantly limited. Stores will be open from noon to 6 p.m. States seeing the openings include South Carolina, Georgia, and Arkansas, all of whom have been far more bullish than other states as far as seeking to reopen their economies. Some of these states have come under fire, but you look, and again, as we mentioned earlier, the impacts of some states and that some states are seeing, like, for example, New York and the Upper East Coast, are a lot different than the impacts of other states and that other states are seeing. And so it makes a little bit of sense. And I get New York-based media folks saying, hey, it's not a good idea for, say, Arkansas to reopen. But a lot of those people haven't really been to Arkansas. It's a little bit easier to socially distance if you're in, say, Little Rock or Fayetteville than if you're in New York or Philadelphia or something along those lines. So not necessarily saying that it's the right thing or the wrong thing, but those local governments at least feel as though they're in a spot where they can at least partially reopen these economies without tremendous negative impact there. Now, Belk is introducing curbside pickup at certain locations that won't be fully reopening just yet as well. So kind of taking that Kohl's approach to things. And although they don't have a specific time frame for the reopenings chain-wide as Macy's does, they do aim to open more stores as local ordinances ease in May. And again, they're in the southern United States, and the southern United States just as a whole seems to be a little bit more bullish about reopening those economies. So we'll kind of see how Belk treats that. Meanwhile, some retailers have actually gone the other way. They've extended their closures chain-wide. One interesting retailer was Bed Bath & Beyond, Hudson News in airports as well, Foot Locker, and Kirkland's. Now, in the case of Bed Bath & Beyond and Kirkland's, you could see why the stores weren't necessarily performing all that well to begin with before COVID-19 hit, but not really a reason to chance things. And if they get another 2 to 4 weeks with employees on furlough, it's again 2 to 4 weeks that they're not going to have to pay employees for what could be very slim traffic levels. Well, that'll do it for us here on the first part of the podcast. Coming up after this break, we'll talk to Paul Cohen. He's the National Sales Director for Crexie, not only about Crexie's platform, but also about recent goings on in the landscape of retail real estate, especially through the lens of what we've seen over the last couple of months with the pandemic. It goes without saying that coronavirus has impacted just about everything in the retail landscape, something obviously we've covered at length on the show, but there's one subject that we'd love to talk about on the show that's seen its share of impacts as well, and that's retail real estate. Joining us to discuss impacts of not only COVID-19, but other recent goings-on in the landscape of retail real estate is Paul Cohen. He's the National Sales Director for Crexie. Crexie, if you're unfamiliar, a fantastic platform that connects the commercial real estate community. Paul, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Trent. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Now, first, Leighton and I on the show, very familiar with Crexie. As we were talking about before we interviewed, I'm on it at least once a day. Leighton has the page open as his browser all the time. But for those that don't know what Crexie is, could you give us a little rundown about what you do on the day-to-day?
Yeah, so Crexie is an open commercial real estate platform where anyone who is licensed in real estate can list a property for sale or lease on the platform. And then anyone out there, so if you're sitting there right now, you can just log into Crexie.com and you can start searching properties for sale or properties for lease. And it's 100% open. We're the only open platform out there. Everybody else either charges you money, makes you sign up, makes you join a special club or something. We're just open and anyone can search. And I think that's been key to our success and our rapid growth. We're coming up for 5 years now and we've surpassed some incumbents that have been out in the market for 17, 18, 19 years. And really because it's this open platform, cloud technology, and we use, you know, AI to help match the buyers or tenants with the properties through the commercial real estate broker. So in a nutshell, that, you know, Crexie's that open platform We'll have about 1 million people in there looking at deals by the end of the year on a current trajectory. And who knows where we go from there.
So that's a little bit about what Crexy does, what Crexy is on the day-to-day. Now, as you mentioned, you've been in it for nearly 5 years, at least as far as Crexy is concerned. So you've seen a lot over those 5 years. But kind of the biggest question as it relates to current events is, how has the last 2 months, not just with COVID-19, but other macro-level developments, impacted the commercial real estate landscape, especially as it pertains to sales and acquisitions and people maybe looking to sell or buy?
Well, that's a huge question. I mean, I don't know that there's anything other than COVID that's on people's minds right now. I mean, everybody in the industry started the year on an up note. We were flying along. We were growing at a pretty rapid rate. Nothing has really changed for us at Crexy, although traffic is up about 23%. So more people are coming into Crexy and looking at deals and interacting with listings than they were in February compared to where they are today in sort of April. So that is interesting. You know, most brokers that we speak to say that the market has kind of stopped as far as transactions in general, but I'm in a lot of, you know, LinkedIn groups and different groups, and I know a lot of brokers. I've been in the industry for about 28 years. I was a commercial broker myself for 28 years. I worked for companies like CB Richard Ellis, NAI many years ago, had my own firm. So I know a lot of brokers, and they tell me that transactions are, you know, because buyers are like waiting to see what happens. However, deals that were already in the pipeline are still getting closed. There's a few extra hoops they have to jump through. Some of the lenders are trying to change the numbers a little bit, but they are still closing deals. I don't know the future, Trent. Nobody does. I wouldn't like to speculate, but I think the general sentiment is there'll be a sort of V-type recovery as soon as everyone's back on the streets and back to business. There's such a pent-up demand from capital. People want to buy properties. You and your partner are still looking for properties. Once you figure out what the future will hold, then you're going to step back in. Will you want a pricing reduction at that point? Will you look for a bit of blood in the water? Couldn't speculate. We'll see. We'll see what happens throughout May, and I anticipate sometime in June, you know, people will be back to some form of normalcy.
You mentioned your discussion with brokers that are in the industry. We've kind of talked with people off air about this as well with brokers, and they seem to indicate that there could be maybe potentially some momentum away from something like restaurants, for example, and towards essential retailers, maybe towards those neighborhood grocery anchored shopping centers. Is this something as far as the traffic on your site that you're seeing, or is it, again, still too early to tell if there's going to be any real momentum one way or the other?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't speak to specific product types. There's a whole data team that knows it inside and out. I don't know generally which properties are doing well. And everybody I speak to has a different opinion, and they're emphatic about their belief system. I find it to be not based in too much data, just sort of anecdotal. I was on a call with a broker yesterday, and he told me that office was dead, you know? And it's like, sure, you know, because people are used to working from home more. Maybe they're not going to go back to the WeWork and sit next to people they don't know. But nobody knows if that's true. Hotels, retail, as you said, certainly makes a lot of sense. But at the end of the day, people need to shop. They like to shop. And I don't see why they wouldn't go back to doing what they did. They'll go back to staying in hotels. We all remember the last big financial shock, which was, you know, the financial shock of 2008, 2009, or even before that, 9/11. You know, people didn't fly for the first few months, but, you know, before long, everyone's back on planes. So I don't see people changing too much what they're doing. I just think they'll think about how they're doing it in a little bit more of a thoughtful way. And that's all. It's just accelerating what we're already doing. This virtual world, you and I talking today, is all part of that sort of natural progression to move things online. And that Crexy's looking to take advantage of that. You know, people doing business online is why Crexy was created. So we're optimistic about the long term of this.
You mentioned before that site traffic up 23% this year. So we know people are still very much looking for properties. Do you have anything as far as listings? Have you seen momentum for listings continue to increase on the platform?
Yeah, I mean, we measure new listings on a daily basis. We measure new brokers on a daily basis. But on average, it's up every day. I mean, every day a new broker or, you know, hundreds of new brokers join Crexie, and with that there, you know, a couple of hundred listings. That hasn't, in fact, if anything, that's increased. Why that's increased? Probably due to the fact of, well, actually, I think it's two things. One is word of mouth. We were selected by the National Association of Realtors back in May to be the preferred provider for commercial agents around the country. So they're all in group chats, CCIM, SOR, all of these designations. They're in group chats. They're like, hey, you've got to check out this new site. The other thing that's happening is they have a lot more time to deal with this stuff. They're sitting at home. They've already organized. I was at a friend's house the other day. He's a commercial broker. He showed me how he's already organized all his closets and finished all these home projects. So now he's sitting at his computer and now he's getting all these listings up to date. You know, so brokers have the time to do that now. And I think that's worked to the platform's advantage. We were already on that trajectory, but it's just increased by a pretty big factor.
I'm curious also, have you seen any momentum as far as maybe listings or activity surrounding certain areas of the country? Are there certain areas of the country where you're seeing a little bit more momentum through the first 4 months of this year than maybe others?
It's been interesting, and you'd think it would be more localized, but maybe it's the way we conduct our business. I mean, we, to the credit of a lot of our leadership, we've created some pretty good technology to sort of track what's happening at Crexie. So we have dashboards and it shows the entire United States where we're adding listings. And so it's pretty universal. Obviously, North and South Dakota isn't adding as many listings as, you know, Miami, Florida, but we're still adding listings. And our goal is to be the place where all the listings are. You've been in the business for a while, Trent. You probably remember the day where there were sites out there that when someone said, I wanted to find a deal, or you were looking for a property yourself, you went in and all the listings were there. That kind of changed a few years ago through pricing models and changing the way that they did business. And so Crexie has filled that void. We're now the place where all the listings are, and we want to make sure in every MSA across America, and there's 364 of them, I believe, we want to make sure that we have all the listings in every one of those markets. So this is not just us sitting here waiting for people to click on Crexie and add a listing, which they do, but we're also proactively reaching out to brokers in every market across America to make sure that they know we're here and they can put their listings on for free, Trent. So there's really no good reason not to do it, as far as I can tell. If someone has a good idea why they shouldn't put their listings on Crexie, let me know, but I haven't heard of one yet.
One of the things that's intriguing is you mentioned the data, obviously, that Crexie has access to. Now, I know nothing much is going to catch you by surprise. You've been in the industry for a very long time, but at the same time, is there something that you've looked at, maybe even over the last year, widening our scope to the last year, that has maybe caught you by surprise or raised your eyebrows a little bit data-wise?
I mean, look, there's just so much data. We have a fantastic data team at Crexie, and they sort of send us interesting insights. I mean, what's interesting to me is capital flows. I don't know of another site that does it this well, but, and I do this a lot, when I just had a call with some brokers in Athens, Georgia, just prior to this, and what we can show them in real time is where the buyers are coming from for their market. So a broker in Athens and a broker anywhere in the United States, they tend to be sort of very focused on their market. They know what they know about that market, and most of the buyers they know are from that market. But when you show them a map of the United States and say, well, for your market, for retail properties, this is where the buyers are coming from. And they, you know, if they're in Athens, they probably knew buyers were coming from Atlanta, right? That was a no-brainer. But when they see Portland, Oregon, or Houston, Texas, or, you know, Raleigh, North Carolina, and places like that, they're like, that's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that. What we can also see is, you know, why that's happening. Is it a arbitrage effect for cap rates? If I'm selling a property in Miami at a 5.5 cap retail, and I want to do a 1031 exchange, where am I going to go? And so when I go to an Athens, Georgia, and see there's an 8 cap for with a retail tenant that I know the name of, so I'm pretty comfortable with that tenant, and it's a 7.5 cap, I've just, you know, this is amazing. And then you're in that business, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. It's, you know, you've died and gone to heaven because you sold something at a 5.5 and you're buying something at an 8.5 cap. You're just making that spread. Your income off of that new property is so much greater. And we have a pretty good transparency into that. That's, I think, one of the most interesting things as a former real estate broker, seeing that sort of transparency. So that, I think that would be the number one thing that I kind of am amazed about on a daily basis.
You touched on cap rates, and basically for those that don't know, or for those that might not be familiar out there, it's a rough proxy for the return on a property that you're getting. I do want to actually touch on the cap rates, because you mentioned cap rates might be condensed or compressed in certain areas versus others. Looking at the past, and again, with your experience in the industry, what type of momentum have you seen regarding cap rates in the retail real estate industry?
They're indexed to interest rates, but they're also indexed to risk. So there's a lot of factors, and this is, I think, probably beyond the scope of what you want to talk about. Cap rates haven't really changed much yet, just because we're in sort of a holding pattern, right? I think once people get back on the street, then we'll see if there's any adjustment in pricing. Obviously, over the last 10, 15 years, cap rates have gone down and down as interest rates have gone down. Money's essentially free these days, so there's a lot of capital chasing these properties, and so that pushes down the cap rate. So I haven't seen like an adjustment. If you're asking, has there been adjustment in the last 30 to 60 days? I don't have access to that data. I haven't really seen it as far as listing prices, as far as what properties are selling at. And we do track sale properties on Craigsy. So we have a very robust comps platform, which is fueled real time by the sale broker. So if property sells on Craigsy today, the listing agent will put the, you know, sales price, therefore the cap rate that was associated with that sales price. And then we will catch up with the tax record in whenever, 30, 45 days from now, just to match that and to verify that that deal was actually done at that price. And nobody's doing that. So from that, we could determine a look back and tell you what has happened, but it's not like the stock exchange where you can go on right now and see, you know, rates are down, such and such. There's kind of a lag to the data in that world.
Once again, Paul Cohen, the National Sales Director for Craigsy, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Trent, pleasure. I'm here anytime. Call me. Love to chat.
Well, we thank Paul for joining us on the podcast, and we forge ahead to an earnings call from one of the retailers that could, in theory, be helped by stay-at-home orders that released earnings this week. And not so much a retailer, but more a marketplace where retailers can join up with customers. This is eBay, who reported on Wednesday of this past week, and despite a dip in after-hours trading on Wednesday, their share price was more or less even for the week, given overall market fluctuations. The market did finish down on Friday pretty significantly. Now, we add this caveat anytime we talk about eBay. They are more than just their marketplace platform, although less so than they had been, certainly. Their classifieds platforms are also a source of revenue for them, although a smaller source of revenue than the marketplace. And up until recently, StubHub was a holding of theirs as well. They completed a sale of StubHub this past quarter with maybe the best timing possible. They received $3.2 billion net of income taxes for StubHub. And I say the best timing possible because StubHub probably not seeing a lot of traffic now, with concerts and sporting events being canceled or postponed. In any case, on the show here, we're mostly concerned about the marketplace platform. And so, Leighton, most of our focus will be in that direction. We start with the numbers.
For most publicly traded companies that we talk about here on the podcast, the numbers for an earnings call are pretty much the most important part. But there is a lot to dive into as far as their approach and strategy going forward and really trying to boost total traffic to their marketplace platform. But first, we do start with the numbers. We see adjusted earnings per share for eBay came in just about analyst expectations at 77 cents per share versus 72 cents per share. Expected revenue also beat expectations, coming in at $2.37 billion versus $2.32 billion. Even still, this was reflective of a 2% drop from the first quarter of last year overall. However, the number of more import to us, marketplace revenue, came in up 1% when accounting for foreign exchange effects, at $2.1 billion, accounting for nearly 90% of overall company revenue. So just to be clear here, marketplace, that what we know eBay for, their marketplace platform, brought in $2.1 billion in revenue, total revenue for the company is $2.37 billion. So you can see really where their bread and butter is. You see, while top line revenue is important for the company, we were actually really interested this time to see their other numbers like active users. First, we should mention that there is a distinction between gross merchandise volume, the product that is actually moved using the eBay site. You're looking at the total purchase price for all products having traded on their platform, and then revenue, the money eBay actually brings in from those sales, those third-party sellers for those particular products. The company was clear that by many of their internal metrics, the company was outperforming initial expectations coming into this quarter, in part because of positive sales flow resulting from COVID-19. And it's funny, Trent, because a lot of people aren't talking about eBay right now, but they're talking about Amazon and other online merchants who maybe have a brick and mortar presence that is closed currently due to COVID-19. COVID-19 has caused a lot of people to shop online that normally wouldn't. So they're seeing a lot of new traffic, and they're seeing a lot more traffic from current users of the eBay marketplace platform. They mentioned that traffic, buyer acquisition, conversion ratios, number of items sold, and gross merchandise volume were all metrics which they were seeing solid performance in within their marketplace division. And when you look at the numbers a little closer, things don't appear quite as rosy sometimes. Gross merchandise volume was ever so slightly down when accounting for foreign exchange effects versus last year. Further, gross merchandise volume was actually down 4% in the United States year over year. Their main increase was actually seen completely in their international segment. To be fair, U.S. gross merchandise volume only makes up around 30% or 36% of their total gross merchandise volume. So you could forgive eBay a little bit for overlooking the domestic market, seeing how much of a presence they now have internationally in all of these other countries. Still, their long-term success will almost certainly involve a plan where they capture more market share in the United States. And that's what this overall strategy talk is about that we'll touch on a little bit later. But it isn't too much about performance here improving year over year, but performance beating internal expectations, which is exactly what gross merchandise volume did. So also their revenue from transactions edged up slightly year over year by about $15 million. To summarize, while they aren't moving quite as much product dollar-wise on the site, eBay is seeing more revenue from those sales. In particular, the active buyers metric saw a 2% boost year over year globally, which we would consider a pretty decent win for eBay if it weren't flat sequentially. While we don't put a ton of stock in sequential numbers, it is somewhat instructive to really look at web traffic numbers and active buyer metrics. Their active buyers have been right at 174 million over the past three quarters, indicating they maybe have plateaued somewhat with their current product selection out there. And Trent, this all comes amidst the new hire of CEO Jamie Iannone.
And he comes to eBay via Walmart and Sam's. His hiring was generally applauded by long-term sellers, but his job ultimately will be to find a mechanism to maybe break through that plateau, Leighton, that you mentioned with them being at 174 million active over the last three quarters. Even if you go back to the quarter prior to that, it was 173 million. So looking at basically each of the last four quarters, that number has been stagnant. So this might be easier because they've shed StubHub, and if they can get rid of their classifieds branch, as is rumored, they might be rumored to be selling that off. Now, the lack of focus over the years, obviously, we know that they held PayPal in their portfolio, they held a number of other companies in their portfolio. You could make an argument that that's hurt eBay's marketplace platform with a number of different business groups kind of absorbing attention from corporate. I don't want to say they had kind of corporate ADD as far as that's concerned, but certainly not having the marketplace platform as their primary focus didn't help the marketplace platform. Now, expectations were also high going forward. One of the things they mentioned on the call itself is that eBay expects net revenue growth to be back in the positive for the second quarter. They're looking for growth of 2 to 6%, so quite a large range when they're excluding currency impacts. And obviously some of this they project because of the impacts of the stay-at-home orders. They didn't withdraw guidance going forward for the full year, but they didn't revise it either in light of the COVID-19 impacts. Now, self-regulation has been a major topic of discussion for the likes of Amazon and eBay. It's no different. eBay had to step up self-policing efforts to ward off predatory sellers and the resulting bad PR. We got some numbers and some clarity on this on the earnings call. They estimated that as of the earnings call, they had removed or blocked over 15 million listings globally that were in violation of their price gouging rules. So things like hand sanitizer, for example, that were in high demand around that time. Now, additionally, they're working to remove or block products that have false or exaggerated health claims, at least according to their monitoring teams. They've also taken the steps in some circumstances to kind of help out their sellers a little bit by waiving listing fees on certain listings or deferring seller fees to kind of support sellers' cash flow during these times. Now, as far as steps they're taking to improve the seller experience, which in theory could also improve the buyer experience on the platform, and this is not regarding the COVID-19 impacts. This is something that they were working on separate from that, but they have a new managed payment system, and that's being well received by sellers. The managed payment system, in fact, has handled $3 billion worth of gross merchandise volume to date. And of course, PayPal is still a widely accepted option. eBay and PayPal will oftentimes be tied together in the minds of consumers, but eBay is hoping that a built-in managed payments platform will draw more sellers, or at least draw sellers to do more volume while providing ease of use for buyers as well. Additionally, and this is something that I found pretty important, they launched an image cleanup tool designed to optimize seller images both on the selling page and on Google Shopping, which is linked to eBay. So improvements like these, which they are designed on the surface to make things easier for sellers, they're really designed with the buyer in mind, making it easier for the buyer to find these products, but also giving buyers a consistent experience. And that's really been one criticism of eBay, the lack of a consistent buyer experience across all sellers, because some sellers you get poor images or selling pages that look like they're still straight out of 1997. They're using like, you know, 30 different fonts on a single page. Sellers all use different tactics or language. The more eBay can streamline that, similar to what Amazon Marketplace has done or Amazon's own marketplace platform where they're listing products from third-party sellers, the better it's going to be long-term, especially domestically for eBay. And that's going to be a benefit for eBay as an organization if they can streamline appearances, although some sellers would argue that any effort to streamline appearance might infringe on some of the differentiators they've developed as a seller. And if you do any research about eBay sellers, you know that a lot of them, especially the high volume sellers, feel as though they've picked out various differentiators for themselves. So eroding that on eBay's end might be a negative for those high volume sellers that feel like they've been able to craft differentiators to make them stand out from the crowd. But long term, this is absolutely vital for eBay to compete with the likes of Amazon. I'm going to be honest, I used eBay for the first time this last quarter to buy a couple of items that weren't going to be available on Amazon until June. The trustworthiness of the site certainly comes into question when you see word art in 18 different colors on a seller's page. There's a lot of early 2000s, late 90s web things still going on eBay. It would benefit them, at least from a buyer's perspective, to streamline a lot of these things. And yes, it might at first be an agitation point or a friction point with some of those longer term, higher volume sellers. But I think if you can make the point to them that this is overall going to be a good thing that's going to build the trustworthiness of the platform, I think maybe at some point you can get the point across that it's going to benefit everyone. I totally get where the longtime sellers are coming from. If you've crafted a certain approach or if you've crafted a more professional look than other sellers, giving sellers a professional look out of the gate, that might be a difficult thing to swallow. But at the same time, if you can do something that's going to continue to bring traffic to the platform, and that's what eBay is all about, how do we build the number of active buyers that's been stagnant over the last couple of years, really, when we look at things? That's going to be kind of a rising tide, ideally, eBay hopes, that will lift all boats and as a result generate a bit more revenue from those merchandise fees.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment that we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I take a look at a story we're keeping an eye on over the next week, month, or year. I'll start because mine's fairly short. We got information this week from the research firm Forrester that said that they are predicting it will take 4 years for retailers to recover to pre-pandemic levels if that recovery does occur. They also estimated that global retail sales will fall by an average of 9.6% in 2020. Again, that's globally. Non-grocery sales will fall more than that, around 20%. But the reason I'm looking ahead is this. By 2024, they expect everything to be accelerated towards e-commerce. They expect a third of non-grocery spending to be online. The reason I'm looking ahead is two things. One is I'm going to assume that this comes true, that we see a third of sales online. How will firms make money ultimately if that is the case? We have seen just this last quarter from Amazon, partially because of coronavirus effects, but partially because their margins weren't great to begin with. Amazon just isn't really making money on the bottom line, even though they are doing a ton of business. We see other businesses like Wayfair, for example. We mentioned earlier in this podcast, Wayfair losing tons of money quarter after quarter. So we see traffic going to these e-commerce websites. If you're not Target, if you're not Walmart, if you're not to a certain extent Kohl's, if you don't have these systems robustly built out where you can fulfill from the local stores, how will you make money? Shipping costs are only estimated to go up. And of course, if you followed any news regarding the Postal Service, there's an argument that maybe the government won't fund the Postal Service quite as much as they have been doing to this point. So if you see increased costs to ship packages, if you see perhaps shippers maybe increasing their prices, knowing that this shift is going online, how will those sellers make money? We've talked about it before. E-commerce has really been kind of a race to the bottom to this point in the U.S., even e-commerce with when it comes to grocery. So how are those firms going to make money? That's my number one point. Number two is, assuming this takes place and assuming we see a movement away from buy online, pick up in store options, what is going to happen to the real estate that will be affected? And of course, we always talk about real estate on this podcast, but a lot of maybe doomsday predictors are saying that we're going to see all of these empty shopping centers and the like. One thing that we've found from this particular pandemic is that people seem to like to go out. They don't like being cooped up in their houses. We see this all the time. People aren't just with pleasure staying at home. They want to go out. They want to go out and do things. So if the assumption is, well, everything's going to move to e-commerce, or a third of sales is going to move to e-commerce, where does that in-person interaction lie? Does it lie with restaurants? Does it lie with bars? Does it lie with entertainment sources? We know certain malls are moving towards those entertainment venues, but at the same time, during a pandemic, those close down just the same as any other retailer might, and they might take a longer time to recover because people might be more hesitant to assemble in groups, depending on kind of how seriously they treat the coronavirus pandemic. So ultimately, that's what I'm looking ahead to. If this comes true, is there going to be just a bunch of empty buildings out there? How will people get out of the house and spend their time? Or will people realize that maybe staying inside is just better for them and their personality, which opens up an entire different set of questions for retailers? So that's kind of what I'm looking ahead to, is if this comes true, what actual impacts will it have, and will anyone be profitable in the new retail landscape?
Sadly, my looking ahead has to do with the pandemic, but on the bright side, it has to do with one of the retailers we talk about often on this show, the largest retailer in the United States and one of the biggest globally, Walmart. Walmart introduced a pilot program that is offering express delivery that allows customers to pick up over 160 different items. So they have 160 different items to choose from, and they're able to get them delivered to their home within 2 hours or less. This pilot program started in mid-April, but they're expanding this program because of the stay-at-home orders throughout the nation. So they're expanding this program to touch a number of stores. Their goal is to reach 1,000 stores in early May, and they're trying to be available in nearly 2,000 stores in the weeks after that. So express delivery actually allows customers, like I said, to order 160,000 items from multiple categories. And this is one of the most important parts, because While grocery stores do have things like express delivery for food items, it's not only going to be Walmart's food and consumables, but also some general merchandise items as well. So you're talking about toys and electronics and hardware, things that are included in that 160 item batch that you can't get at all other retailers. And I think this is very interesting, Trent, because not only were they going to inevitably roll this out because of the competition with Amazon, so long term, this is going to be their strategy. But right now, it's just so fascinating how they're able to hurry up operations in order to get this done with nearly 2,000 stores in the next few months amidst this pandemic. So it really speaks to the amount of employees that are behind this project, and it speaks to the amount of money and resources that Walmart has put forth right now in a time when customers, again, with stay-at-home orders currently still in a number of states, really need it the most. And I think it really speaks to the opportunity that Walmart has here to gain market share. And we talk about online market share and we talk about their brick and mortar presence. Well, Walmart always has been trying to grow their e-commerce platform. And over the last couple of years, you see, of course, those double digit or year over year increases approaching really, really good numbers in total customers using their online platforms. And of course, they've been pocketing acquisitions of smaller startup companies in the e-commerce space and niche categories like apparel and outdoor goods. But overall, you're seeing Walmart really get behind this notion that, you know what, we need to build out this infrastructure and we need to do it right now. And I think it's very interesting. They're going to rely on 74,000 Walmart personnel to fulfill these orders. That's a huge estimation of what's going to be needed. But it really speaks to the amount of customers they feel are going to be engaged in this platform. And obviously, sooner is always better. And so anytime you can get customers to be able to click on an item and then get it to their doorstep within an hour and a half, 2 hours, they expect a lot of work to go into that project. And not only that, they're going to be using third-party delivery services, some of the same companies they've already been using for 1 and 2 day delivery options right now in order to fulfill some of these orders. So again, third-party companies are going to be taking those items that Walmart personal shoppers have already curated, they've already picked up. They're going to be taking those batches of items, and then they're going to be sort of the link between the store and the home. It's going to cost customers $10 on top of the normal delivery charge. However, caveat here, if you're a Walmart Delivery Unlimited customer, you'll simply just pay $10 per express delivery. So each time you deliver via express delivery, if you're a Delivery Unlimited customer, it's only $10, no extra fees on top of that. I think this is very interesting. This is a total value proposition because right now customers are still loading up on a number of items. You see carts full of groceries anytime you go into a Walmart, and that brings me to my last point here and my looking ahead story. You see Walmart really doing a good job right now, keeping their stores clean and orderly, but really making sure all of the stores that can remain open are staying open. And with very limited guidelines, they're not really going above and beyond what the municipalities are pushing. And I feel like that's going to be good for their top line in the coming months as they begin to report some of the hard data, the hard numbers that comes out of this pandemic. I think Walmart's done a great job of really telling their customers that they will be there to service their needs. Again, whether it's grocery, whether it's hard lines items, whether it's soft lines items, I think it's going to be a very good image for Walmart. And it's reflective in their stock price, by the way, too. If you look just a year ago, their stock was right around $99 a share. Right now, it's $123 a share, or very close to $123 a share at close on Friday. And you're looking at a company that, by the way, hit an all-time high at the height of the pandemic in mid-April. So investors, long-term investors, short-term investors, analysts, they're all seeing the value proposition that Walmart's put forth and saying, look, we're here for the long term and we can really get through any downturn, whether it's short or long, in the economy. And by the way, make sure that our employees are taken care of, benefits are still being paid out, and making pretty much every stakeholder happy. And I think that really speaks to the size of their business and really the amount of resources they've put forth over the coming years to really evolve to customer needs and to be able to push out Express to 2,000 stores in the next 2 or 3 months is an incredible feat. And you, again, you see it in their stock price. The current market cap for Walmart is around $348 billion. It's certainly worth, in my opinion, every bit of that, knowing that they've lost no market share, and if anything, have gained market share during one of the most trying times in U.S.'s history.
Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus podcast. Once again, a big thanks to Paul from Crexy for joining us during the interview segment. Coming up next week, we'll talk to Megan Martindale. Excited to talk to her because she's going to bring a bit of a different perspective as far as what we're seeing with pandemic-related impacts, not only on the retail industry, but with the restaurant industry. She is the global head of research for CBRE. Super excited about that. But as we mentioned, we'll see you 7 days from now. Be safe.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.